Helping Up podcast, all about addiction, recovery, and grace. I'm Vic King. I'm a chaplain at Helping Up Mission. We're on the 1000 block of East Baltimore Street, and today we've got an interview for you with Yassine Abdul Adel. You'll hear about how Yassine went from being, as he calls it, a blippy in the 1960s to now working on his master's degree in counseling in his 60s. It's an amazing story. We hope you enjoy it.
All right, so Yassine, first off, tell me a little bit about your family. We're not used to first name, your last name. So just say a little bit about your family background.
First of all, it would probably be helpful to know that Yassine Abdul Adel is not my original name. Okay, my original name is Gary Marvin Stacy.
And that's what that email was about. Okay?
I come from a Christian background. My father, my biological father, was a minister. My grandfather was a minister. We were Pentecostal. I was in the church most of my life.
In
Knoxville,
up?
Tennessee. I was born in Detroit, and I was grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. And so I definitely do consider myself a Tennessean because I love the land. I love the people. My grandmother died at an early age, which changed things around. My mother ended up remarrying after she had divorced from my brother's father. My mother ended up going to school and becoming a registered nurse. She was one of the first registered nurses in Knoxville, black registered nurses in Knoxville. And she went on to become a professor. I'm very proud of my mother, very proud of my mother. She did a whole lot of first things in Tennessee as a black woman.
Wow.
There's just so much.
Well, so where's this name
come from? I was
Muslim.
I started exploring spirituality or understanding, you know, like God, because I've always had a connection with God. You know, just even when I was young, the Bible and things that people said in the Bible, you know, it always affected me differently because I seemed to have an understanding of some of those things.
And growing up with a father and a grandfather who were pastors, so
okay,
you know,
but
I understand that.
My father, I didn't know he was my father. That's a whole nother situation. But I believe in genealogy, and I believe that sometimes that those spiritual things are passed on, you know, in genealogy. Mm-hmm. So growing up, I was involved in church matters, and I went to church, and I, you know, had the spiritual life. But then it came about that I started exploring, you know, like what things meant. I started exploring the Trinity. I started exploring, understanding what it actually meant. And the only thing that stood fast was, you know, like one God. And so, and that seems to be the primary, you know, like focus of Islam. And so, well, I studied them, and then I went to school, and this was in my early 20s. I studied Islam in the Islamic Student Center in Indianapolis, and I studied those things. And I was Muslim for about 25 years.
All right, so you were growing up in Knoxville. You got interested in Islam while still living in Knoxville? Would have declared yourself a Muslim for, you said,
25 years?
Yeah. Okay. All right. During that 25 years, did you get involved in drugs or alcohol?
Yes.
So that was part of your, even though that's not what Muslims teach, you were hanging out with all that stuff. Did you go to college?
No, I didn't go to college until after I had been incarcerated. I started college right after high school, but going to college was for, you know, like having fun and partying and stuff. Yeah. I was a child of the 60s. I was a child of the 60s since I was a blippy. And so, okay.
So,
you're going to edit that?
A lot of my friends are blisters.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, at what age did you start drinking or drugging?
I experienced alcohol, you know, in high school. But I never was a drinker. I think in my senior year of high school, I smoked marijuana a couple of times. My graduation present was to allow me to hitchhike to California. And it's because, remember, child of the 60s and everything. It's 1969. Yep. And it's like I had to beg, you know, like for the whole first part of the year, like to allow my mother to, you know, like Yeah, please let me know. So that was my graduation present to allow me to, 3 days after I graduated from high school, I hitchhiked to California. And during that time, I, you know, experienced like marijuana and drinking wine and LSD and those things, you know. That's where I think things really began, because I associated getting high and drinking with that whole newfound, you know, like sense of freedom. And the new life and, you know, like new understandings, new experiences. And I think that's where the getting high started. I think I'm one of those people who became addicted as a matter of use, although it is genetically in my family. But I can remember times when it was just like not important to like to drink or wasn't important. But then I also remember the time when I wasn't drinking or using when I went out, but I was going out to drink and use, and anything else that happened was a matter of self. So I think, you know, like the onus changes of what it is that you go out to do. The onus changes from, you know, like I'm going out to get high, you know, as where it was once. I'm going out to, like, for the weekend, you know, to have some fun, on the weekend or something like that.
You started with some marijuana, some alcohol in high school. You graduated next to what
yes,
chemicals?
When I was out in California, I tried, you know, like heroin. And it was like, because I was in California, we were going up and down hills, and I was like throwing up everywhere and everything. It's like, nah, that's not what I want to do. And so, you know, and for a few years, you know, it's like, I never thought about, you know, like injecting drugs again. It's like, no, that's not me, you know, just drinking wine, maybe taking some acid, you know, and smoking marijuana, you know. And then it got to that point where we started going through some problems. And I think it's important to mention that one of the things that, you know, being a blippy or black hippie or whatever you want to call it, you know, and being who I was as far as my mother was concerned. And so, because like she was a faculty member by that time at the University of Tennessee, and some of my associates and some of the things that I did were with mixed groups. Then when you start to become aware of yourself and everything like that, you know, you start having these cultural conflicts, et cetera, you know, and so then a lot of things develop. But the point being is that I felt like one of the things that we did, you know, like, say, you know, we sit around and we got high and talked about the country and how bad it was and how we were being treated bad, you know, as, you know, as a group of people and black people speaking of. Then everybody was getting high in those things. And so I started like using some of those the injectables. And I think the first thing I used was at that time was a thing called Nurmorphine, which was a synthetic morphine, and which pretty much like we're doing today. And then, you know, you couldn't get those. And so you start using heroin and da-da-da-da-da-da, you know.
So was heroin a major drug of choice? Did it migrate to other things later?
Cocaine. And then pretty much got to anything, you know, injectable. And over the past 20-some-odd years, it was crack cocaine and alcohol, which I think I have a theory about why that is. Well, no, I think that some of those things, you associate certain feelings with cocaine. And when you're alone, and because I spent considerable time in it, you know, incarcerated in the penitentiary and stuff. And a lot of those things that you associate with being alone, et cetera, you know, you the cocaine and all of these things. They kind of like alleviate that. But anyway, the whole point being is that, you know, I started using cocaine after I graduated. You know, I went back to school after I was incarcerated and, you know, did real well, was working and doing well and everything. But some of those old things came into being. And a lot of the things that I have issues with, and these are some of the things I've learned here and some of the therapy I've had, you know, had to do with like my abuse. A book called The Wounded Heart by Dan Allender, I mean, opened up so many things for me. It really just like, oh, wow, you know, and you start to see back on some of the things that you were doing. You start to see back on some of the feelings that you were having. You start to see back on some of the ideas, you know, how you formulated different habits and different emotions. And a lot of the things that I was doing, I've taken the time to here to go through those things and talk about them with the guy who's doing mental therapy, and he is like, he's amazing. Dr. Arrington is amazing. I ought to give him a raise. But he's amazing, and he helped me through a lot of issues as far as the drugs, associating like how those things fit together.
So do you consider yourself an isolator? Okay, so you're very comfortable by yourself.
Yes.
But you do it. Gotcha. Now, when did the first jail time
hit? In 1984.
And you would be how old?
33. About 33. Okay. And what happened was I had just gone through a divorce. I've been put in jail for public drunkenness and stuff. And I just gone through a separation. You know, I had a good job. Somebody took something from me and I took it back, you know. But of course I took it back.
Yeah,
and
I
took it back
arrested.
And there isn't somebody else's and somebody else's.
Okay,
I basically had an armed robbery charge. The thing about me is like I've never lived that life of like in the street and stuff because my mother wouldn't put up with it. And so when it came to like dealing with the court system, I had no idea, you know. And I was like remorseful and everything. And they said, here's what we're going to give you. I said, yeah, I'm sorry. I did it. And so he gave it to me. So they gave me 35 years.
35 years for that armed robbery charge.
First charge you're caught is
35 years. Wowzers.
Yeah, that's what I said when people say, you know, like, well, trust me. I said, yeah, that's what my law. The last time I trusted somebody, I got 35 years. They basically let me feel like they were doing me a favor by not giving me life.
You're lucky, only 35 years. You know, wow. So that's when you said you went back to school, college.
I did 2 years while I was incarcerated, and I was a really good prisoner, and they had, you know, like college courses, and they paroled me. I had been locked up, incarcerated for 10 years, and the next day I was like, on a college campus, you know, it's like, and which was really crazy, you know, because like, you know, I know I wouldn't want my son and daughter, you like to be walking around with somebody who's been incarcerated for 10 years. But anyway, I did well.
So you finished, you 10 years, you got out, you've already done 2 years of college. So then you went to the college campus,
University
what college?
University of Tennessee at Martin.
And so there were a student.
Yes, sir.
And did you finish that program?
Yeah.
And what was
psychology.
Your degree?
Psychology.
Did you do 2 years on campus?
Yeah.
So you got your four-year degree in 4 years, finished with a degree in psychology. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, you said you had a good job. Did you have a career field prior to that?
Well, I just seemed to be able to do anything, and unfortunately. But I was in data processing. I was an iron worker. I was a welder, and I had done all those things. And when I first got married in 76, I started working for a company called Daniel, which was the second largest construction company in the world. And I would start working in a data processing office, and I started, you know, at the bottom and correlating. And we'd send checks to all over the world, and we'd send reports to all the different places. But the wanderlust of hitchhiking and stuff like was still in my bones, and I was like, I wanna get outside. And so they had like 1,000 jobs all over the world, and so they sent me to welding school in Baytown, Texas, which is one of the dumbest things I ever done. But anyway, they sent me to welding school, and so I became a certified welder.
And still working for Daniel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to college, got your psychology degree. You'd already been through a marriage. That's when you got incarcerated, shortly after that. Did you use, in your 10 years in lockup, did you use it all?
No.
Did you use during those next 2 years of college? And was it a big bad
experience?
Yes, it
was.
Or just
dabble?
Big bad experience at the beginning? No,
it was. I was in school, and they called me up and said, well, are you coming to pick up this check? And I said, what check? And they said, well, this $1,400 check. And so they gave me money for the second semester of summer school, and I had this extra money. And I had not done anything except go to school since I had gotten out, which, you know, was about a year and a half. And so I came to Knoxville. And say, well, I think I'll have me a party. And I ended up like running into a telephone pole and almost killing myself and stuff. And stuff.
And what'd you use?
Cocaine and alcohol.
Cocaine, back to your stuff, yeah. So then did you use your psychology degree ever anywhere in particular?
That kind of like straightened me out for a while. But when I got out, I worked for a company called Youth Villages. I was what is known as a teacher counselor. I was in wilderness therapy. I worked in crisis intervention. Whenever the police department went someplace and there was a crisis involved, and then they would call us and we would go there.
So you really used your training in the helping professions to serve people, help people. And you felt good about doing that.
Absolutely.
Were you using for most of that?
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
I think part of that, and this may just be my own, you know, like, I don't know, rationalization, but I get involved with people and I get attached to people too much. And when I get attached to people, you know, like I, you know, like go around in my head with stuff. And one of the things that I have learned to do here, as a matter of fact, is like set boundaries. And I've learned that, you know, if you can help somebody or talk to somebody without, you know, getting so involved. There is a boundary with which you can help people, but you have to leave some things there. And I was not able to do that before, especially with the kids.
I got you. So meaningful service, some decent jobs, helping people, feeling good about what you're doing, off and on using. When was your next incarceration?
I worked for about like 4 years. I relapsed and I got into an altercation where my parole officer said, if I don't put you back in, either you're going to kill somebody or somebody's going to kill you. So he put me back in, you know, a parole violation. Okay, and then it started a 10-year cycle of, you know, getting a job, working, relapsing, then going back to the penitentiary.
Were you the kind of guy that every time you relapsed, you'd break out?
Absolutely. I said bad case of going to jail, I'm a vendor, you know, and I think the majority of that part is like being able to have the time to focus on your problems. Once again, that's one of the things that I've been able to do here. It's like,
you really can't teach an old dog new tricks, can't you? I mean, this old guy, he's old enough, he's done it all, and he got here, sat down, settled down, listened, and it's just picking up insight after insight about himself.
Yeah.
This is wonderful.
I mean, it's I was just telling Ms. Scott today, actually.
You're a therapist.
I have a bunch, because I'm 60. That's one of them over there, too. See, but that 28 days is just, for an old head like me, it's not enough.
Did you do 28 days?
How many fingers you got?
You've done plenty. Huh?
Especially when you don't know what the issues are. Yeah. Because the only thing you're doing is basically, you know, getting yourself sober, but you're not getting to like the foundation of some of those problems. And most of the time, as it says in the big book, you know, it's a spiritual malady, you know, and it's an issue that, you know, you have to discover it first of all.
So 34 years of incarceration.
I mean, 62,
age,
I think it was.
So over half your life incarcerated. So then how did you wind up getting
Knoxville Area Rescue Mission?
In Knoxville,
it's a mission there. When I got out of the penitentiary, see, my mother, which is, I think, is significant, she has Alzheimer's. I was working at Fort Campbell, and she had Alzheimer's, and I had to go home and take care of her. Once again, you know, like I was working, trying to take care of her. I didn't understand the whole Alzheimer's thing. I understood caregiving, but I didn't understand the how deep it goes with Alzheimer's. I relapsed. I went over to the CARM, Knoxville Area Rescue Mission, and they allowed me to come into that program.
So your last incarceration was when?
2013. Okay. And I got out February the 16th or 13th or something like that. So it's something 2013. And got into CARM. Did real well. They have a program there. I started working and I became manager at the Hilton Garden Inn in the kitchen. It was doing real well and everything. And then, it, you know, just stuff. And I relapsed again, and
any of the stuff related to family?
Yes.
Family was work, you know what, pressure stuff?
Work too, because like I was the manager, and I was being asked to do stuff. I was working a lot of hours, but I wasn't taking care of myself, I suppose. But anyway, I relapsed.
again, cocaine, cocaine, and alcohol.
Because, like, Carmen, if you know anything about Carmen, it's just like this, except it's worse. You know, just like we have the, you know, like you can walk around here and you like get dope anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like right there, yep. though, it was like they, it was under the bridge, and it was just like, you know, my boss, you know, she was like, just get yourself together and come back to work. She is, her name is Tracy. We still communicate and everything, and she's an angel.
I'm sure you were a great worker. I know you. I don't doubt she would love to have you back there. So I totally understand why she would just say, do what you got to do to get yourself together,
yeah.
and I'd love to have you back.
But totally see, the thing was, that. They called up here. It's like, a year? Are you serious? And she said, man, you need to think about, like, how many times are you going to, I mean, like, go in this circle? And she said, don't you just stay here, you know, for a few days. Just don't go anywhere this week. Don't leave the building. And so I didn't leave the building. And
took
I,
suggestions.
Yeah.
Took suggestions.
And I called and talked to to Kevin, and so he said, well, just come on up here. So I came up here, and I think it was a good decision. It was absolutely a good decision. So many things have happened.
So being here, one of the things about you being here is you started mm-hmm. playing music, mm-hmm. and you picked up music when and where
I've
in your
always
life?
Been playing music, but I've never had a chance to concentrate on music, you know, like over time. You know, mm-hmm. I'd play for 6 months, I'd mm-hmm. play for 4 months, I'd, you know, and then, you know, you can't play if you pawn your guitar all the time, you know. So, and, you know, so I would pawn my guitar and I wouldn't play for 2 years, 3 years or something. But this has allowed me to, you know, just get in and just play some and be a part of a band and be a part of something. And the music also, I love gospel music. Sure. I love gospel music and I love Christian music. And because I love Jesus, that's one thing that I haven't really said anything about. There came a time when I realized that there is something different about Jesus. There is something different about what he said. And, you know, and I'm not really, you know, like a mainline Christian, but one thing I do, I love Jesus and I love the way that he exemplifies mercy and grace mm-hmm. and forgiveness. And when we realize that, you know, how many times that we don't quite hit the mark, that's the only thing that that really matters. Because, like, he's the only one who personified that. You know, we could go into like the aspect of, you know, like the Son of God and Trinity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he is the only person that was his message. And that message, you know, like resonated with me in it.
At what point did that hit you? While you were in lockup? While you were working with all those kids?
Where no, I was in Nashville, and I was working in Nashville at the Doubletree in Hermitage, and started going to church. And they had a tent revival, and there was this song called, like, Have Your Way. I know people say, well, it was just emotional. I said, no, it wasn't emotional. It was just time.
Yeah.
That was my transforming moment. But over the time, I have studied. And I went home that night, and I opened my Bible and opened it to Romans 8. Since then, I have what I consider, you know, like my understanding of what Christ is and what Christ means to us. And Romans, I mean, it's the heart and soul. I believe it's the heart and soul. Just like my name, Yasin. Yasin means it's like the heart and soul of Quran. But when you say it, you're like, therefore, there is no condemnation to them in Christ Jesus who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For the law is the spirit of life, and Christ Jesus has freed us from the law of death. But, you know, people don't forget. He said, therefore, there is no condemnation to them who do what? People say, therefore, there is now no condemnation for them who walk in Christ. Who what? Who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. I'm not going to preach, but a lot of people get that wrong. They just say, okay, just because you do that. No, but you got to be doing something, too. There is an if-then in, an if-then statement. You remember logic? If you do this, then this, you know. Because, like, if you don't, then you're still doing the same thing that you used to do. You're not walking after.
You recited it from memory that day.
That's right.
Interesting.
Yeah,
it was very meaningful at one of our monthly talent shows. So, and you at some point earlier than that, you had given up on Islam. That did not work for you.
Okay,
and
let
you
me just
given
say,
up on that.
No, it didn't work. It does not work for me, but I'm not saying that it doesn't work for somebody else.
You were floundering, looking for something, and came back for you for your to your Christian roots. So here at Helping Up Mission, the band was really important to you. Then you got involved in the running team. Talk a little bit about that.
I tried for 6 months to get on back on my feet. Whenever I have done well with my sobriety, it's always been with some physical activity. We have some tough women out there. They hold you accountable for the things that you do. It's not that you're like, okay, well, I'm going to run it. Oh, no. It's like, and they get in your face and they tell you, well, where are you? How come you need to do this? You know, and it's always good for me because we not only run, we have financial literacy classes. We have resume classes, things that we do for the community. I appreciate them. I need the team. I'm a team person. It's hard for me to be a part of a team because I'm working on it. It's getting better, but they're all great people. They really are.
And another thing that's happened here, you've mentioned it a number of times, is your mental health counseling. Yes. The band is a voluntary thing. The Back on My Feet team is a voluntary thing. But mental health counseling is one of the requirements that we want every guy to really give it a good shot. Mm-hmm. And that's been really helpful.
Absolutely.
To you.
I have four people in different times, you know, who aid me, you know. There have been times when I really needed help. And then there have been other times when, you know, like I just needed some polishing the rough edges and stuff. And because I have experienced so much, I get different things from different people. Because I think one of the things about me is that being exposed to so many things in my life, been exposed to the streets, but I've also been exposed to living with people and living amongst people who have like been fairly well off, really well off. And that's one of the things I think that makes me lonely. It's because like finding my own niche, you know, finding, you know, like a group, you know, because I know I can see things with this person that, and then when people try to pull me into a whole niche, I'm not willing to go. I'm because I know truths about this group and I know truths about another group. And I'm not willing to like just fall into like anybody's clique.
All right, now, you really took advantage of what's going on here at Helping Up Mission. You jumped in with both feet. You're enthusiastic, you're energetic, and you go after stuff, and you certainly don't seem like this.
64 in September. 65 in September.
64-year-old guy.
65 in September.
Okay, and I'll be 65 in December, so I'll be right behind you. You don't seem like you seem like an energetic, much younger man, and you have hair. I'm very jealous
it doesn't grow
of
though.
That, by the way.
It doesn't grow though.
I'm happy for you, believe me. And we're graduating in October. A couple other things interesting about your time at Helping at Mission. One is you started back
school. Yeah, I was going to mention.
Say a little bit about that.
I did, like I said, I have a degree in psychology, but things have changed in the helping profession to a certain extent, to a great degree. Because I was speaking to someone today, whereas counseling was you just had a degree in psychology and then you'd be a counselor here, the counselor there. Mm-hmm. Now, counseling itself, you know, it's becoming a profession. You know, I am working on getting my certificate in alcohol and drug counseling. And from there, those courses will fall right in line with the University of Baltimore's master's program in applied counseling and applied psychology, which includes counseling and industrial psychology. So with the courses I already have from graduating and with the courses that I get after this year, which I'll be able to finish the certificate program in a year, I will have just a short time to get my master's in applied psychology.
Wonderful.
So
wonderful. So estimated time of master's degree program graduation
I say 2.5
is?
Years.
I say 2.5 years.
66.
And you'll be how old?
66.
Don't you know that's too old?
What else am I going to do?
All this stuff? You see, and I'm so proud of you, and I expect God to give you years to continue to use that. But he's going to use you even in all your training time. So
I really believe that. And also, I'm running a marathon.
Okay, and that was the other thing I wanted to ask you about. So in October, you're going to graduate. Yeah. And also in that same month, in fact, almost the same day, you're going to be running in the Baltimore Running Festival, and you're running the full 26. Marathon.
Yes, 26.
26.2 miles. You've been running with back on my feet for, maybe
three months.
3 months.
We're doing 10 miles on the weekends now.
And so up to 10 miles on the weekends, and you're training with a group of people that are going to run the marathon, and you're going to run with them. And you'll represent back on my feet and helping up mission as you do that. That is really cool. Now, what are some of the life lessons or maybe recovery lessons that you're getting out of your training? And you know, especially as we take it to the next level, really this endurance run. Yeah. What's coming out of that?
Yes, because I have a tendency to like overtrain, and sometimes you forget that you're 65 years old and you don't drink enough fluids and everything. And then when I woke up on Sunday, I was almost crippled. I was just really sore, and things just didn't function right. And I just wasn't feeling right. And, you know, it's like, let things happen. Just let things happen. Just let things happen. One of the areas that I'm really interested in is helping people who are my age to gain insights to possibilities. When I say that, many times in recovery programs or just in recovery itself, people are satisfied to like just get a check and sit back and not do anything. And I think the possibilities of training, I think the possibilities of enlightenment, the possibilities of people being aware of like what's happening around them and in the world are open to them. And I think that those things, I'm really interested in helping people to see their possibilities. That's one of the things I'm really, I really am.
Very good. Well, look, thank you very much.
Is there anything else you wanted to share that DG didn't ask you? Anything on your heart, any kind of...
Well, I think you could expand the band budget. The band, I think it really does a good job. It does. I mean, because a lot of times guys come in there and the music, you know, like really opens up something. It allows them to just move and go in places and it helps. It really does help. Miss Kim, I don't know, she ain't got to come up in here and do all this stuff, but she comes up here, man, and she takes it serious, man.
Yep.
Yeah, she
believes
does.
In us.
Let me see. I don't know. I just guess that's about it. I mean...